Hey, everybody. It's Natalie and Patrick Lynch. Thanks for listening to the Bloodstream podcast, our monthly 360-degree look at the bleeding disorders community.
Bloodstream Stories is something new for us on this channel. It's a long-form, three-part nonfiction audio journey.
Like Radiolab or This American Life, for instance.
Where we take a deep dive into one subject important to our community. We'll have more of these in the future, but this one, The Factor Revolution, is about the treatment revolution of the last 60 years and the complicated but massively important role of Factor in that revolution.
We're pulling from over 40 interviews conducted by us and our collaborators at the HIV Story Project, from the film Bad Blood, and from news articles and reports over the last 60 years.
This series and the Bloodstream podcast is made possible exclusively by Shire.
Thank you, Shire.
Bloodstream Media is proud to present The Factor Revolution, The Last 60 Years in Hemophilia Treatment.
Clotting Factor came along in the 70s, the miracle drug that allowed us freedom to go to school and have jobs and build our own families.
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we would go to the doctor and he'd get Factor, and it made our life so wonderful. I mean, we just dealt with hemophilia. It wasn't an obstacle anymore.
With over 40 interviews from community members, doctors, and advocates, we take a deep look at the history of Factor treatment from the 1950s through today.
What I think happened in the 80s was just a lot of disbelief at first.
We started hearing rumors about AIDS in the late 70s, early 80s.
I made a decision that I wasn't going to tell anybody I had hemophilia.
The Factor Revolution pulls together source material, news reports, white papers, and original audio content from the film Bad Blood and the HIV Story Project.
And today, with prophylaxis, these patients really can. They can live a normal life.
Vigilance really is one of the keys in that shared responsibility that we have as patients.
We ended episode 2 coming out of the contamination crisis of the 1980s and the early 1990s, hearing Dana Kuhn describe his feelings now, some 30 years later, discussing the good he's been able to wrangle from the tragedy.
Dana's description of using the pain to drive change is similar to what we hear and see from so many who survived the crisis. In this third and final episode, we're going to look at that good, that change that has occurred over the last 30 years.
And you know, occurred is the wrong word now that I think about it. Let's be specific. It's not like change just kind of happened.
Yeah, that's a great point. Change in the community was hard fought and ongoing.
Yeah, the people we're hearing from in this entire series have been on the front lines for decades, fighting for change, for better blood safety, for better efficacy, for better regulation and oversight, and for a more robust, engaged community.
And one of those people you've heard from in the previous two episodes. Here she is again. This is Sue Garrity.
I think a lot of the healthcare providers really struggled with what happened. You know, you couldn't backpedal, you couldn't go back. All you could do was look forward and really spend a lot of effort trying to always stay on top of what was available to the patient, the medications that we could get for them. So it was really a trying time. But out of that trying time came our recombinant factors. So children today, obviously anyone born after 1992 had the ability not to be exposed to a plasma-derived clotting factor. But on the same hand, the plasma-derived clotting factors that have been available since, in that time period, are all very good clotting factors that have not transmitted any viruses. But it gave patients a choice.
It's an important idea, choice. In the midst of the factor revolution, as we're calling it, there wasn't much choice. You had to use blood-based factor.
But you heard Sue mention the development of recombinant factor here after the contamination crisis. Recombinant was a huge step forward, finally giving patients a choice between blood-based factor and synthetic factor.
Many of you will be familiar with the terms recombinant or synthetic. For those who aren't, recombinant factor means the factor is derived through a DNA cloning procedure, not through actual human blood plasma.
The process was engineered first in the early 80s, then put through clinical trials, and we'll talk about clinical trials later, and then first sold to patients in the early 1990s.
Now, it's important to note, we are not advocating for recombinant over blood-based products, just highlighting that by the early mid-90s, patients had a choice.
Then as time went on, those recombinant products were improved upon. The volume to infuse went down significantly.
As we advance, there has been, I think, a tendency to think that blood safety is an issue of the past.
This is Mark Skinner. You've heard his voice throughout the series.
I really fundamentally disagree with that. I think it is absolutely important that we remain engaged with the blood community and the manufacturers in monitoring safety. That vigilance really is one of the keys in that shared responsibility that we have as patients. You look at the headlines and all of the new viruses and pathogens, the new infections that come up in the blood supply, whether it is West Nile virus or Zika or SARS, about any given year you can see something new that's emerging. And the pace of emerging viruses around the world is constant.
Mark raises a critical series of points here. Blood safety is an ongoing, unending journey because, as we've said before, we're dealing with the human body, the reality of pathogens, medicine, and money.
And all of those things meet at government, politics, policy. The federal government and, to some extent, state governments are the ultimate protectors of the people and therefore of the blood supply and of consumers of medical therapies.
Yeah, coming out of the contamination crisis, one of the biggest lessons learned by the bleeding disorders community is that we needed much stronger, much more organized advocacy at every level of government to help hold manufacturers accountable before, during, and after treatment.
Today, our two national organizations spend a tremendous amount of time and energy organizing advocacy efforts across the country and on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. We spoke to the head of those efforts at the National Hemophilia Foundation, Michelle Rice.
Hi, I'm Michelle Rice. I'm the Senior VP of External Affairs for the National Hemophilia Foundation. My primary role is to coordinate our federal and state advocacy. One of NHF's federal asks that actually had been going on for many, many years was to remove lifetime caps on commercial health insurance. We probably went to the Hill every single year to talk about the importance of that, specifically after recombinant therapies came out and you know, factor coverage was more expensive.
What Michelle is referring to here is NHF takes delegations of community members to Capitol Hill every year to lobby for much needed changes in healthcare law.
Due to the work that we did there, it helped to ensure that the removal of lifetime caps went into the Affordable Care Act. A lot of the patient protections in that program helped the bleeding disorder community as well as many other rare disease communities. But a lot of that were things that we had been talking to Congress about for years. Our influence on that was clear because then President Obama used hemophilia as somewhat of a poster child for the Affordable Care Act and for why some of those changes were needed.
We probably don't have to tell many of you, but the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, revolutionized care and insurance for millions of Americans, and especially those with chronic conditions. It was a mandated end to lifetime caps, to barring people from coverage for pre-existing conditions like bleeding disorders and other chronic conditions. And it required essential health benefits to be covered.
I'm Andy Slavitt. I was in the Obama administration up until January of this year, overseeing the Affordable Care Act and the Medicare and the Medicaid programs. The ACA is enjoying record popularity. So the question is sort of what happened and why did that turn around for the hemophilia community? This is very important. Up until 2009, it's as if insurance was designed for the benefit of insurance companies. So all the things that would be necessary to protect you if you were an insurance company, that you could suss out whether someone had the kind of medical history or even the kind of behavior or even the kind of life circumstances that would cause them to have an expensive medical expense would allow you as an insurance company to not write them a policy. It goes beyond even people living with conditions like hemophilia, but people who are living with domestic violence were often denied insurance and could be denied for any reason. So, you know, the important compact change of the American public that was made with the ACA to say, let's not design insurance for the insurance company. Let's design it for the insurers. And as easy as that sounds, that's a fairly significant change. It requires everybody to change how they do things. But as we've made enormous strides. And in point of fact, there are so many people, so many communities that this helps, but that perhaps weren't vocal about the how important those gains were. For the first time, many people who have not been politically active are saying, hey, wait a minute, this is something that affects me and my community. And even more importantly, and I think more interestingly, there's a lot of people that have said, hey, wait a minute, this may not affect me, but this affects my neighbor or my cousin, or it affects the situation that I might be in at some point.
That's one thing we talk about here at Believe Limited and Bloodstream Media all the time. The level of engagement at all ages in this community is through the roof. We've actually done feedback research internally and seen community surveys and market research from outside groups that show young people, teenagers, in this community want more education and clarity about their bleeding disorders and their treatment.
Yeah, this is also a great time to mention that a lot of chapters have programs specifically aimed at teen leadership. The National Hemophilia Foundation has NYLI, which is the New York Leadership Institute. And of course, every year, most chapters have advocacy days where they train families and then go speak with lawmakers in their state. There are just a ton of ways to get involved. Another reason to remain vigilant and engaged, the revolution is not over. It's out of its infancy, for sure. We can say it's entering its adolescence.
Right. The revolution stabilized for a bit, but now it's exploding wide open and expanding into new areas.
New treatments, new concepts of treatment. This is Sue Garrity again.
We have newer and better clotting factors that continue to evolve. In 2014, the first long-acting factor came on the market. And so we had a long-acting factor 9. Today, we have 15 different factor 8 products. We have 9 different factor 9 products. So patients have a lot of choice and are working with their health care providers or physician or nurse practitioner to select a product that works the best for them and their lifestyle.
For the foreseeable future, I don't see the community moving away from plasma therapies. On the other hand, there are enormous advances going on in the treatment of hemophilia itself that are moving towards recombinant technologies, to novel technologies that bypass the clotting factor cascade in our blood system, and to potential curative technologies such as gene therapy. Is plasma in blood still important to the hemophilia community? And I think the answer is yes. And I guess I say yes for two reasons. Hemophilia is part of a family of blood disorders and bleeding disorders. And so looking at the bigger picture, there are still large segments of the bleeding disorders population, particularly those that live with rare factor deficiencies and those that live with von Willebrand disease, who are still highly dependent upon plasma-based therapies. So the importance of what goes on in the blood collection system and blood safety is fundamentally important to those populations. And looking beyond the United States, large portions of the world are still using even cryoprecipitate and fresh plasma, as well as plasma-derived clotting factor concentrates are an important mainstay of therapy.
So just because clotting factor remains a mainstay of treatment, and it does, doesn't mean that treatment has stagnated. As we're going to hear throughout this episode, the revolution is expanding beyond factor.
My name is Stephen Pipe. I'm a pediatric hematologist and oncologist at the University of Michigan. I'm a professor of pediatrics and pathology. I direct the pediatric hemophilia and coagulation disorders program here at our center in Ann Arbor. What we're on the precipice now is still some products that are in clinical trials, but really exciting efficacy results from these so-called non-IV or non-replacement therapies. These are products that are not replacing the factor VIII or the factor IX molecule, but they're treating bleeding by other mechanisms. They're delivered subcutaneously. That has some advantages if someone has a really difficult venous access. Hasn't been tested yet, but this introduces the possibility of being able to treat maybe quite young children earlier. These drugs aren't intended to work to treat acute bleeding. And we do know from the clinical trials that patients time to time will have a breakthrough bleeding event or a traumatic event that means they need to have acute treatment. So you have to use an alternative agent. So if it's a non-inhibitor patient, presumably they would just infuse their regular factor VIII or factor IX. If it's an inhibitor patient, they have to use a whatever bypassing agent they're used to using.
Not sure if you caught that, but essentially, because non-replacement therapy does not rely on factor, when or if a breakthrough bleed happens, you'd still need to fall back on, you guessed it, factor.
This is one of the reasons we've referred to factor in this entire series as the bedrock of treatment now and for the foreseeable future. It's so consistent and so commonly used that it will probably remain a bedrock here for a long time.
But that doesn't mean access to that factor will always be easy or protected.
Oh man, we have to talk about insurance again, don't we?
Yeah, sorry.
Here again is Michelle Rice.
Right now, unfortunately, I think we're still in a position where we're having to try to protect those patient protections that went into place. You know, the ability for young adults to stay on their parents' insurance till age 26, lifetime caps, pre-existing conditions, access to comprehensive, to affordable, adequate coverage. I think right now we are still at a point where we're having to try to protect that from being taken away in some of the changes that are happening in the new administration. The big trend that we're seeing is much tighter management of the hemophilia space. And what I mean by that was, in the past, we had a handful of drugs. And while it was difficult maybe to choose or to find an insurance plan, once you found one, you pretty much had access to all of the different therapies. Well, now it's a great time to be in hemophilia because there's so many new drugs and new advancements. So you have lots more options. But because there's more options, that can tend to be difficult for insurers to manage their cost. So now they're starting to do preferred drug lists. So they're starting to say, well, if you take this drug or this drug, you know, it'll cost you this much. But if you want to use this drug, you're going to have to pay more. And you may have to prove that there's a reason you need this drug over the one that we prefer.
Now, of course, most community members understand intuitively the problem with that structure, being provided a narrow list of treatment options and then having to make a case for why those treatment options aren't working probably means a lot of pain. And the idea that you have to suffer for a while in order to try new therapies and new treatments is hard to swallow.
That concept is either called step therapy or fail first therapy. And the big question that we've asked insurers who have started to implement this for hemophilia is, well, what do you consider a failure? And who decides that? Is it one joint bleed? Is it just a breakthrough bleed? Is it a head bleed? And our argument has always been, you need to understand in this disease state, one failure could be life-altering or life-ending.
Some patients we know from actually doing pharmacokinetic studies on patients, we know that some patients respond better to one factor than to another. And if we had a very limited amount of factor and the factor that was available was the one that a patient didn't respond so well to, then that would be unfortunate for that patient.
Further complicating things, I guess in a good way, is gene therapy.
The last real precipice is availability of gene therapy.
This is Dr. Stephen Pipe again.
This community has heard about gene therapy for a long time. We've had excitement and disappointments in the past, but I think this is the real deal this time around. We have therapies that are offering safe delivery vehicles. The factor levels that are achieved appear to be durable over many years. The levels that we're achieving now with some of these protocols are really unexpected. We have a couple of clinical trial programs now which have pushed the factor levels achieved with gene therapy into the high mild range, above 30%, and in some cases all the way up into the so-called curative range, which would be in the normal range, so above 50%. So I think people are really excited about the later phase trials for these gene therapies. They're just moving into phase 3 now, which is the last pivotal step before submission for approval. So I think we're really hopeful that this is a really important next step for overall treatment.
We can't talk about the evolution of treatment, and especially the future of treatment, without talking about clinical trials.
As our community becomes more and more aware of the expanding universe of therapies, from long-lasting factor to gene therapy to non-replacement therapies,
we become more and more aware of the clinical trials where these therapies are tested. The stakes are high. Positive results, so to speak, in any trial will likely change the lives of thousands of our community members.
But trials are just that. They're tests of the effectiveness and safety, primarily of each new therapy. And neither the effectiveness or safety are guaranteed going into a trial, obviously. So there are times where devastating news filters out from a clinical trial. We would all benefit from a better understanding of the clinical trial process. Each trial is a little different in structure, but one thing is consistent: the levels of diligence mandated by the federal government.
We asked Dr. Pipe, whose voice you've heard throughout this episode, to walk us through these levels of diligence.
Well, everyone should know that these clinical trials they're regulated by the FDA and the European authorities if it's a global trial. So that's the first level of diligence there. All of these trials have these scientific review boards that look over the complications that might be seen in the trial. And these are independent panels that adjudicate the events over the course of the trial, and if they see any safety issues that they're concerned about, they have the latitude to ask for changes to the trial or even halt the trials entirely. But there's another level of diligence, that's in the post-approval stage. We know that every possible clinical scenario can't be anticipated or even covered in the course of a clinical trial. Most of these clinical trials are going to happen with, 60, 80, 100 patients. What happens when you expand out to thousands of patients across the world and all kinds of clinical scenarios? And so in the post-marketing phase, I think particularly for These are such a paradigm shift in how we treat patients. Almost certainly there will be an obligation to collect data from patients after approval. And I'm pleased that over the last decade, we've been able to set up databases in the U.S. that almost all of the patients in the U.S. participate in that collect this data. These data sets are collected through the hemophilia treatment centers. They send data to the federal government, such as the Centers for Disease Control.
So in short, there's a new-ish tool that doctors, manufacturers, and advocacy organizations all reference to judge the safety and effectiveness of a new therapy.
We've got a number of hurdles to jump through with these novel therapies, but I believe we've got the platforms in place to monitor patients over the long haul. And that's going to be particularly important for gene therapy, right? Because we're not just talking about looking for adverse events maybe in the first few weeks or months after gene therapy, but we want to be able to give people confidence over multiple decades that this is a safe route of transformation for the hemophilia community.
A patient I saw not too long ago reminded me of this.
his parent did, and he is now in college. And this mom said to me, you know, when we first met with you, you talked about gene therapy, and you said within 10 years we would probably have gene therapy for our patients. Well, it's 20-something years later, and we still don't have gene therapy approved for our patients. So we were very optimistic, but and that's kind of maybe that's why I'm a little reticent to say let's all jump on the bandwagon and we're all going to have, you know, these new products. And a lot of patients, that's why a lot of patients are still using the standard factor 8 and factor 9 products. They are not going to jump on that bandwagon right away. They want to see how people do on it.
Uncertainty will always mean, for the foreseeable future, factor is a default treatment because it works and it's stable.
It's really been breathtaking to see the transformation just in my career of working in hemophilia. What the prospect was for a baby born in the 1980s, now, you know, 30 years later. In full confidence, I tell families that their boys that are born today are going to live to be, you know, very old gentlemen, same as their peers. And I fully expect that they will benefit from all these new technologies and the way we deliver care, that they have the opportunity to perhaps have healthy joints throughout their life. Now, I don't think we're there yet. I think we all recognize that even though we've done a great job with prophylaxis, there's still patients where that's challenging. There is, annualized bleed rates are not zero, so patients still do have breakthrough bleeding with trauma and other types of activities. So factor is always going to be with us. As I mentioned, even with these non-IV therapies, we're still going to need factor from time to time. So we're going to benefit from just having this full complement of therapeutics that we can choose and optimize for each individual patient and hopefully give them the best life possible.
We don't know where the factor revolution or the overall revolution in treatment is going to lead. I mean, ultimately, we all think and hope that this sprint over the last 60 years is leading toward a cure. But we don't know. And we talked about that a lot during the research and interview phase of making this series.
We literally asked ourselves, where does this story end? How do we end the series? What do we tell people?
But here's the thing. We're still in the midst of the factor revolution. Remember the imaginary graph we introduced in episode 1, where there's just this flat line of ineffective treatments for a couple thousand years, and then in the last 60 years, the line just shot up, just boom. Treatment development on top of development, each one building on what came just a few years before.
Well, we're still riding that line that's shooting up to the sky. We're holding on by a thread, just like watching every year as new therapies emerge or enter clinical trials. Just like you and your family and your chapter leadership and the national organizations.
So for now, the best we can do is hold on to our hats, buckle up, and try to enjoy the ride with you.
We'll stay vigilant. We'll stay engaged.
We'll ask a lot of questions and monitor clinical trials.
We'll attend the national meetings and our local chapter events and talk to other community members.
And we'll take good care of ourselves.
And when the revolution reaches its next milestone...
Ooh, I smell a sequel.
Yeah, we live in Los Angeles, so let's use some Hollywood lingo here, Seth. Why not?
Yeah, so when the revolution reaches its next milestone, we'll bring you the sequel.
The Factor Revolution 2.
The new batch.
The new batch.
The new batch.
I'll bring the popcorn.
I'll bring the 3D glasses.
Well, we're not going to make it in 3D.
Yeah, I don't see why we wouldn't.
Because
if we have the technology, we have the technology, so let's do it.
By definition, audio is 1D. It's one dimension.
I always hear three dimensions, and I want to find it.
The Factor Revolution has been a Bloodstream original, produced by Believe Limited, written and produced by me, Ryan Geelan, and Seth Kirshner. Edited by Josh Davis and mixed by Michael Capuano at Iceman Sound.
A huge, huge thank you to the HIV Story Project for sharing their extraordinary collection of interviews with us, and to Marilyn Ness for sharing her film Bad Blood with us. Please check out both works. They're a crucial piece of our shared history, whether you're in the bleeding disorders community or not. A huge thank you to Dana Kuhn, Randy Curtis, Sue Garrity, Mark Skinner, and Michelle Rice, Dr. Stephen Pipe, and healthcare policy expert Andy Slavitt, all of whom participated in in-depth interviews with us for this series, sharing their expertise, wisdom, and memories and insights. Finally, a sincere and grateful thank you to Shire, who makes this entire series possible. They also make the Bloodstream podcast, our monthly 360-degree look at the bleeding disorders community, possible.
To subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast, the community's first and only professionally produced and distributed podcast series, just visit www.bloodstreampod.com. You can listen to every episode right there on the website, or click on links to any of the top podcast hosting sites like Google Play or iTunes.
Bloodstream and our other podcasts, Ask the Expert or the Powering Through podcast or Bloodline,
which is actually pretty similar to the Factor Revolution. So if you like this series, check out and subscribe to Bloodline.
Yep. All of them are available through your preferred podcasting app. So if you typically listen to podcasts via Downcast or the Podcast app on your iPhone or through Stitcher, among others, you can add any of our shows right there in the app, just like any other podcast.
Instead of listing the citations for our research here, we'd like to direct you to our website, www.bloodstreampod.com/factor, where we've listed every research paper, website, newspaper article, and speaker that we cite throughout. Too many to name, but each is incredibly valuable, a good read, and worth checking out if you'd like to do a deeper dive.
You can connect with us on social media at facebook.com/bloodstreammedia or on Twitter at twitter.com/bloodstreaminfo.
Please like, comment on, and share links to these episodes. We build everything we build here at Believe and at Bloodstream Media because we think it's valuable to the community. So we're honored every time something we've produced is shared.
Happy listening.
Happy listening.